moving into two sessions on the question of war as seen not so much by the people who experience it as the victims or the soldiers, nor by the novelists and poets who dramatize its meaning, but in the most abstract sense as thought about in Christian tradition. The reason for considering it fitting to have these two sessions on this subject is partly that in the long range, regardless of timing, certainly in our culture, the place of the military in our life, even in peacetime, is one of the most dramatic and expensive parts of our society. Depending on how you calculate, the present military expenditures of the national budget run anywhere from 25% to 50%, depending on how narrowly you calculate something as a military expense. And all of that, of course, is expenditure that is economically dysfunctional. It doesn't increase our productive capacity, and ecologically wasteful in a poor world. But more narrowly than this, there is also the element of our memories and our self-understanding as a national community. Americans like to forget rapidly the dark pages of our story. Already, we don't pay much attention to the Vietnam experience, although most of us lived it. We were glad somehow to put it behind us without having really resolved it, without really having come to any kind of balance sheet as to what it had meant. There are still people who believe that the basic mistake was not to win it right in the first place by using less restraint, and other people who think that it was wrong from the outset. We haven't resolved that as a national community. Tomorrow is the 33rd anniversary of the first use of the atomic bomb, the most dramatically destructive single weapon ever created and used. Not simply a bigger and better or bigger and worse agent of destruction, but symbol of a new epoch in our time because of the fact that it tapped a new kind of energy and technology in order to bring about that kind of destruction. So it's a fitting time to remind ourselves that it is part of our responsibility to keep aware of the dark pages of our story. Christians should be more able than others to handle the dark side of a story. The acknowledgement of sin is part of our belief system. The acknowledgement of accountability, concern for the future. So it is appropriate that at least annually we should remind ourselves of the destruction that's been done in our name. There are many resources to reach for in trying to deal with that memory. I could say a lot from my peculiar confessional perspective, from one of those small Christian communities that, at least in theory and in hope, have said that war is always wrong. But I think it's more fitting in this context to try to use or to get acquainted with the tools of the mainstream or majority Christian tradition, in which the Lutheran tradition is included. It's not a distinctively Lutheran tradition. It's been held by most churches, the large churches, ever since the 4th or the 5th century, but it is also formally stated as a part of the commitment of Lutheran identity. The Augsburg Confession, chapter 16. It is taught among us that all government in the world and all established rule and laws were instituted and ordained by God for the sake of good order, and that Christians may, without sin, occupy civil offices, or serve as princes and judges, render decisions, and pass sentence according to imperial and other existing laws, punish evildoers with the sword, engage in just wars, serve as soldiers, etc. Toward the end of the same chapter then, accordingly, Christians are obliged to be subject to civil authority and obey its commands and laws in all that can be done without sin. But when commands of the civil authority cannot be obeyed without sin, we must obey God rather than men. A quotation from Acts 5. Now, what is said is not very much in this chapter, but what is implied is considerable, because the phrase engage in just wars assumes a definition that is already there. You can't use a phrase like that unless you assume that it already has a meaning, and it already does in the majority Christian thought of the time of the Reformation. So what is the notion of a just war? That's what we'll be focusing on for this time, and then for Monday we'll ask whether that notion can be used, how usable it is, how helpful it is, what are its limits, and perhaps what are its strong resources. Now, first some superficial observations about this text that I just read. It doesn't claim to be original. It says, in fact, we all believe everywhere. And those who interpret the writing of this Augsburg Confession in 1530 accentuate the fact that it was an effort to reassure the emperor that the Lutherans were not heretics by accentuating as many points as possible where their convictions were not significantly different from the mainstream Roman Catholic tradition. And this is one of those places. This is nothing specifically Protestant or evangelical or biblical. This is a reaffirmation of the mainstream tradition. That's shown by the fact that the word isn't defined. The phrase just war is simply assumed to have a definition. It fits in with a statement about the nature of the realm of the political, about which nothing specifically biblical or Christian is said. In fact, it starts out by saying all governments. And that's to be taken seriously. That means Turkish governments, Slavic governments on the eastern fringe of the known world, any kind of governments. This is not, in other words, it's not gospel. It's not good news. It's simply what we affirm about the realm of political reality. It's interesting that this text even includes a view of sin, which just on the level of word usage is not typical for that period. Three times it talks about what Christians may or may not do without sin. As you know better than I do, Lutherans believe that nothing is without sin, and that it's fitting to acknowledge the element of sinfulness in all that we do, even in our virtue, even in our best intentions, and that you're fooling yourself if you think that anything is sinless. And yet three times in this text, there's a different meaning of the word at work, not the theological meaning of the word sin, according to which it's pervasive, and what we must do is face it, and in fact rejoice in the fact that we may face it in confidence in God's gracious justification. But here there's an ethical, a non-theological view of sin as wrong which may be avoided. You may wage just wars, and that is not sinful. You may participate in whatever civil government tells you to do, and that is not sinful. Except in the case where it does tell you to do something which is sinful, and there you must disobey, which is the Lutheran basis for selective conscientious objection, except that this text doesn't apply to the war field, but it could. Now, when we begin to try to understand the notion of the just war, which is our assignment for now, forgive me if I get schematic and simplified because of the time limits, we're setting aside three other views. I don't mean that people are always clear that they have one of four different positions, but I'm clear that they have one of four different positions. And anyone who seeks to analyze the logic will move in the direction of seeing that there are four different ways of reasoning about war. One way of reasoning is simply to say that no questions are to be asked. A government is a law unto itself. There is no reason for restraint or limitation. And that's a position which was worked out more or less in this same Reformation period by Machiavelli, although it had certainly been practiced and believed before, that the prince, the king, is a law unto himself, and there are no moral criteria to be used in determining what he does. And certainly that's one view to take about war, that whatever government asks for is all right. Well, you don't even ask about all right, it is to happen. That's obviously not being said here. It's being said that at the end of the chapter it is said that you must not obey if they do ask you to sin, and with regard to the participation in war that is without sin, it must be participation in just wars. So the notion of no restraint, the blank check given the government, is set aside. There's a second notion that was very much present in the mentality of the Middle Ages, and that was the crusade. Now, crusade is a specifically religiously motivated war. Not only the crusades properly so called, as the military expeditions against the Near East, but also other military undertakings could be blessed by the church and could be undertaken for reasons which were not really political, law and order, maintenance of sovereignty and those things, but for the sake of the church, for the honor of God, or for the proof of a point. Over against this, the doctrine of the Holy War says no, only such war is justified as has sober political motivation. And the Protestant reformers were quite critical of the Crusades of the Middle Ages as involving an improper takeover of the civil realm by the religious realm. The third view that is set aside is the one that is actually mentioned in the text, and that is the view that all war is wrong. That Christians must abstain from all war, all killing, and if that's part of the package, then even from sharing in civil authority. Although these people didn't actually say that Christians must always stay out of civil authority, they were willing to be pushed out or withdraw if this civil authority included war at the time. These were the so-called Anabaptists, who are condemned five times in the Augsburg Confession, and whose spiritual forefathers ever since the 12th century, to say nothing of the early Christians, had taken seriously at great cost the rejection of all war for believing Christians. These three views are set aside: the blank check, the crusade, and what we today call pacifism. And in between, there comes this view of the just war theory, which says there are no holy causes that justify war, and you don't have a blank check. There must be restraint, but the restraint must not be absolute. In between the blank check and the absolute restraint, there is the relevant restraint of the just war theory. And that's what now we move, after we've located it, to try to interpret. The last prefatory observation is a rather striking thing once you stop to think about it. There are no solid sources for the doctrine of the just war. It's universally held by the mainstream Christians, before the Reformation by all major Catholic teachers, after the Reformation as well by all major Protestant bodies, Anglican, Reformed, and Lutheran. But it's never spelled out carefully. It's an assumption. It's a network of assumptions that hold together in a logical way. Everybody reasons the same way in these matters, but there is no statement of it that is worked out with great care. It's never promulgated by a pope. You can be a Roman Catholic and not believe it, and not be a heretic. It's never been proclaimed as necessary belief for a Roman Catholic. It's just universal belief. Everybody believes it. It's really only the Protestants who have to believe it according to their confessions. Catholics never wrote it into a creed. The Protestants all did. So if you're a Lutheran minister who signs the Book of Concord in order to be ordained, or if you are a conservative Reformed minister pledged to support the Westminster Confession, or the Belgian Confession, or the Helvetic Confession, or the Heidelberg Catechism, you believe the doctrine of the just war as part of orthodoxy, or the 39 Articles of Anglicanism. Catholicism was never that firm, but strikingly, even the Protestantism that took it in and gave it creedal status never defined it. Doesn't say clearly what a just war is. You have to synthesize that inductively out of the sources. The best generally accessible book on the history of Christian thought about war, written by the Yale church historian, Roland Bainton, who's also been a teaching guest here at Holden, I see, by the tape library, has to synthesize the doctrine of the just war by a mosaic of many different quotations from many different places in the writing of Augustine. So it's there, it's all over the place, but it's interesting that nobody ever sat down and spelled it out. The basis on which millions of Christians are going to go to war to kill millions of other people, Christian and otherwise, has never been spelled out in a responsible document. Now, looking at that from the outside, that strikes me as somewhat odd, that I have to come and do the inductive process to put together the doctrine so I can take it seriously. There are numerous criteria. Even the lists of criteria for what makes a war justifiable are different, but they can be sifted and organized and shuffled into reasonable order. And then we come up with four or five major criteria and subpoints under them. First of all, a just war can only be waged by a just authority. As a bandit can't wage a just war, a private citizen can't wage a just war, only a government can wage a just war. In Martin Luther's time, or in the time of Augustine or Thomas Aquinas, this was no special problem, because anybody could tell who a just government is. It's a prince who is the son of a prince who was the son of a prince. You become a just government by being born into it. Then it began to get more complicated since the 16th century. There could, of course, even then be dynastic debates in which two different princes would argue about which of them really had title to the throne. And then there developed processes of election, adjudication, finally democracy, in which what the legitimate government is defined by a voting process, and it can change, or is defined by a constitution, which itself has to be established somehow as legitimate. Even if you know what the government is, there are in addition questions of jurisdiction. Does that territory belong to that government or the other government? Then you begin, as you get closer to this and get more critical, to ask questions about the justice of a regime. Can a government be a legitimate government if it's doing a bad job of governing? Well, that's a new criterion. Luther didn't ask that. Middle Ages didn't. Except implicitly. Thomas Aquinas did once say, sedition is wrong. But if a government itself is so immoral that the prince is, in effect, seditious, that is, he's working against what government properly ought to be, then for you to work against that prince is no longer sedition. Well, that's just the beginning of a thought which leads, finally, to a theology of revolution. If you can claim that a government is doing its job very poorly, you can say it has forfeited its claim to be legitimate, and then somebody else is the just government. And who's that? Well, some revolutionary alternative. Another part of the problem of legitimacy is, of course, not only how government got there, but whether the action it's taking is clearly its action. As if you are a lieutenant in the Vietnam War and a major tells you to go out and kill those civilians, is that really the order of the United States government? Or is your major simply crazy? Well, but in an organized military system, there are ways to find that out. I'm just saying that's also a specimen of the problem of legitimate authority. In the case of Vietnam, this question of legitimate authority was obviously one of those that came to be asked. And the longer they were asked, the more negative the readings came to be for many people. It had to be asked on several levels, of course. Within Vietnam, was the government in Saigon a legitimate government? Well, how do you ask that? Certainly not by the criteria of succession, because there had been half a dozen revolutionary overthrows by the time the war got serious. And each one had only set itself up by a coup d'etat. One of them then had an election in which 35% of the people who had the nerve to vote voted for the existing regime, but they had gerrymandered the party structure such that that meant winning. Does that make legitimacy? Then you have to ask as well whether that was a good government, whether it was legitimate in this modern sense of doing its job well. Not everybody thought that, obviously, or there wouldn't have been a civil war going on. But the question of legitimacy also has to be asked at our end. Are we the legitimate government of Vietnam? Or were we invited there by due process? That's a question between the two countries. Back home there was the question. Is this war constitutional? The Constitution says a war must be declared. This one hasn't been. Around the edge of the Constitution, it has been established that the chief executive has certain emergency powers to send the soldiers to do certain things without a declaration of war. Is this included? Those are the questions of legitimate authority that were serious in our own experience with Vietnam. In the case of Hiroshima, there was, of course, much less of a problem about the legal legitimacy of the American government and the American military undertaking. But there is still question to this day about who made the decision to drop that bomb there, how much President Truman knew about the enormously escalated destructive potential of this bomb, and how much he knew about the target. The first announcement President Truman made about the dropping of the bomb said it was dropped on a military target, which clearly wasn't true in any normal sense of that phrase. Maybe he himself didn't know. In that case, we're again asking the legitimacy question, because you have to ask it not only about a war, but about a particular weapon or a particular strategy. The second kind of criterion to ask, well, just to notice for the future, we have to ask the question of legitimacy, and especially in American cases, due process, about the next war. If the next war that we get into is a major atomic exchange, how will we know that the decision to enter into that exchange has been made by due process? They say the president will have 15 minutes, and they'll spend 10 of those 15 minutes decoding all of the things in the little back bag that somebody's always carrying 15 feet from him in order to make sure they get the message through right. Can that possibly be, in any traditional sense, due process, properly tested, and the result of our government working the way it's committed to work in accountability to its people? If the next war we get into is another Vietnam, we have more reason than before to doubt that our way of getting into it will have run through proper channels. Maybe that doubt itself is now exercising some restraint. Maybe it did in Angola, for instance. But if another one starts, the question will still be the same. Second general criterion for a just war is that the cause must be just. Because you're obviously fighting for something, to obtain something. What is that cause? Not cause in the sense of that which brings in about an effect, but cause in the sense of the goal of one's undertaking. It must be something you have a right to ask for. It must not be something just selfish or whimsical or religious. It must be a right that has been infringed upon in some way. The infringement on that right must be not simply material but formal. Now that's a technical phrase that isn't too hard to explain. It's a material infringement on my right if somebody has my property. But it's only a formal infringement on my right if he knows it's my property. If he thinks it's his property, then he's really doing wrong, but he doesn't know it. Well, you don't have the right to go to war unless it's clear that the offense is formal. That is, that the adversary agrees, knows, that what he has done to you is an infringement on your rights. If there's any debate about that, then you aren't ready yet to use the massive means of war. That's just one specimen of the application of another sub-criterion. It must be a matter of last resort. If you haven't tried compromise, if you haven't tried peaceful negotiations and non-military pressures, you haven't tried arbitration and mediation, you haven't tried a cooling off period, then it's not yet a situation of last resort. A war is so destructive and so incalculable that the people who believe the just war theory insist it must be hedged around with the restraints of last resort. The last criterion that probably belongs under cause, although it could be put somewhere else in the outline, and takes a little more explaining, a just cause must be possible. A just war must be winnable. Because if you can't win it, it certainly wasn't worth the destruction it caused. Because you add to the evil which was done to you all of the additional evil that you do, and all of the additional evil that the enemy does in successfully defending himself against you, and the whole world system, including yourself, is worse off than if you had accepted the initial injustice. So a war is only justifiable if the chances of your winning it are clear. Obviously you have to be sober and you can never know everything, but at least if it's clear you can't win it, you shouldn't start it. There must be good chances of winning it. Otherwise, it's not a valid cause. Stop me anywhere along the way if you have questions on the level of interpretation. I don't mean to debate with the position now, but just to lay it out before us so we can think seriously about how it would work, what it would mean to try to use it. Try to use it carefully.
Suppose a country is forced to starve people,
is that just a little louder?
If a country is starving, well, what would they fight for?
Land.
If the other country has food available.
If you could get food by war, well, certainly the traditional doctrine would say no, because that isn't your food. So the traditional doctrine would say that that's one thing you couldn't do with war. Secondly, the traditional doctrine would say if you're hungry and they're well fed, you're not going to win it anyway. Because a war demands such enormous strength and stamina, both sociologically and personally, that a famished people could never do it. The only way to develop that argument would be the theme of revolution. Wouldn't be revolution in the limited sense, but upsetting the whole world regime in the interests of justice, which would be a potential expansion of the just war theme at a place I'll come to yet. But normally the answer would be no, because the food that you don't have wasn't taken from you. Now, if you could prove that the food you don't have was taken from you in some sense, then that would get closer to the claim.
But, well, the major tenets of the hunger movement has been that everyone has a right to proper nutrition.
Yeah, but that's a modern definition of right. I mean, it may be a correct one, it may be a humane and religiously proper one, but it's not the old definition of right. You had a title to it and somebody came and took away from you.
Well, but doesn't
it's that the system ought to give it to you.
Doesn't that go into the problem you just dealt with before about the difference between the material and the formal
mm-hmm.
cause? That very often that is the confusing issue, because you you know, one government or one country can claim that this is really ours, mm-hmm. but they have taken it, and they say, we've taken it because it is ours, and it's been illegally mm-hmm. or unrightfully being held by you. And that ties in with, you know, when you're talking about resources, or what has been taken or what has been inflicted by the other, for example, if hunger is a result of, I don't know, colonial treatment or whatever, then in fact, whatever you are lacking has been taken away directly or indirectly. So you're getting into that murky yeah. business.
Well, let's just take note that this is one of the several cans of worms along the way. The just war theory, I could have said this as a separate paragraph, it was established and it was found convincing in the age of Christendom. That is an age in which the whole known world, the whole world that you care about, has the same value system. And in fact, even in a sense, the same overarching government, the Holy Roman Empire, even though the empire didn't have much say in local affairs. And therefore, you could assume that most of the terms you use in stating these criteria are relatively common in their definitions. The Holy Roman Empire, even though the empire didn't have much say in local affairs. And therefore, you could assume that most of the terms you use in stating these criteria are relatively common in their definitions. But if you get different worldviews coming together, or different religions, or different political theories in the modern age, then all of these terms of what is a right become unmanageable, become pluralized, and you can't really discuss. But the just war theory is a common sense theory. That means it's what the people at the time thought any old fool would think if they thought. It is not subject to critical perspectives that can adjudicate a pluralistic debate about the definition of terms, and that's a good sample of it. The old sample is, of course, that in many places the question of jurisdiction was very debatable. The lower side of the Alps, the Italians think belongs to Italy, and the Austrians think belongs to Austria. That debate still isn't finished. My family-in-law comes from the left bank of the Rhine, which Germany thinks ought to belong to Germany, and France thinks ought to belong to France. And there are dozens of places in the world like that. And now we're getting a resurgence of the Basques and the Bretons and the Catalans and the Occitans and the Welsh and the Scottish, who think that they were roped into a national unity that they don't really belong into, so that their government isn't legitimate government. So one place after another, the landmarks which were assumed to be solid for this doctrine get wobbly. And that means that taking the doctrine seriously is much more complicated. It doesn't undercut its logic, but it is a serious handicap for its applicability. And the newest form of that is the one that's now been brought up. Questions of economic justice or human rights justice, which we are beginning to be taught to believe stand in judgment on all regimes, even though the injustice being done did not consist in taking away from something somebody they ever had. Like people in Brazil that never had enough to eat, but now somebody's telling them that that's Uncle Sam's fault, or Gulf's fault, or the market system's fault. And that perspective is a new one that is much too modern for this doctrine to have dealt with, but very fitting if we want to ask how we can use the doctrine. But meanwhile, I'm trying to make the doctrine credible and not to find its problems to start with. So we have two major criteria, just authority, or legitimate authority, just cause, and now means, necessary appropriate means. And here we have numerous sub-points as well. The means must be proportionate. That means you must not use an axe to swat a fly. You must not do more damage in your claim to set things right than would have been done on the other side. That is, the damage you do must not be less than the damage you mean to hinder. That's common sense. You must not punish people more than they offended. You must not use overly dramatic sanctions against a modest offense. Secondly, the means must be necessary. That is, it must be something that if you didn't do it, you wouldn't attain your aim. The means must be discriminating. And this is one of the chapters of the just war theory that have been given the most attention because of the obvious common sense consideration that war ought to be fought by soldiers against soldiers. That's the old way of doing it. And that civilians ought to be left out. Or in the Middle Ages, it was even more generous than that. Holy places should be left out. You must not fight in cemeteries. You must not use church buildings for forts. And certain categories of people must be left out. The religious must not be drafted. And various categories of exemption also apply. But in modern times, it's especially the non-combatants. Women, children, old people who are not participants in the war in a direct sense, and therefore you must not bomb civilian populations, for instance. That's the most self-evident sample of the principle of discrimination. In the Middle Ages, there was a still stronger one that we have to stretch our minds to understand. It shows how much we've changed. You must fight according to the moral law. Now, of course, the moral law says you shouldn't kill, and that's one exception that we're making because the war is justifiable, but you can't break any other rules. You must, for instance, not lie. And Thomas Aquinas was very serious about this. It's a sin to lie. Now, you're going to kill, but don't lie in order to kill. You may lie in ambush, but you must not lie. Now, that's a good case. It's not just a pun, because an ambush is a form of deception. It gives the other guy the impression you're not there when you are, but you don't tell him you're not there. So it's not actively a lie. You may deceive, you may let the enemy in his ignorance and take advantage of the ignorance in which you let the enemy, but you must not tell a falsehood because that would be a sin, and Thomas Aquinas doesn't believe in sin. Or torture. Now, I think it's very important to understand the nature of the concession to violence that's made by this doctrine, to know that these people thought they were being very traditional and rigorous at all the rest of the points that constitute a moral system. It was not anything goes. The rest of the moral system must stay intact. Only at this one point do we make exceptions. You have the right to kill your enemy. But you must not use prostitution, you must not use theft, you must not pillage churchyards, you must not torture. So the moral law must be respected. And lastly, written law must be respected. That is, if there are treaty rights, they must be respected. If there are holy places, if there are truce regulations, they must be respected. If there are exempt categories of people, they must be left in their exemption and not drawn into the hostilities. Now, this is one part of the game that still does exist and is updated. That is, the Geneva and Hague Conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners of war and the right that the International Red Cross has to have access to prisoner of war camps and such matters. Those are cases where there is still some seriousness to this system, that the written system of laws is to be respected. The treaties into which the belligerent nations have entered are not suspended, but are applicable, especially those which have to do with the conduct of war. All of that is under the heading of just means, but as I said, the most sensitive and the level on which people are usually the most conscious is the matter of discrimination and the immunity of civilian populations, which has obvious applications both in the Vietnam type of war, where it was very hard to know who was a civilian, and in the atomic type of war that we're thinking about, or that Hiroshima represents, in which the size of the weapon and the difficulty of defining any military target and the effect of a fallout are such that you can't really pinpoint a specifically military objective. The last criterion, the major overarching title, or maybe it's two, is the criterion of intention. I say maybe it's two because it's used in two different ways. In one sense, an intention is what you hope to reach, the objective intention. What is, that's just a wider expansion of the concept of cause. What are you fighting for? You must be fighting for peace. You must not be fighting for pride, for the restoration of your humiliated prestige from some earlier event. You must not be fighting a crusade. You must not be fighting to gain territory that's not your own. You must only be fighting for the restoration of the best possible peaceable world order. That's the objective side of intention. But there is also, at least in the medieval material, the subjective side of intention, that is, what does it mean to you? And here we find, going all the way back to Augustine and quoted in Thomas Aquinas, the kind of thing that we find in Jesus in Matthew 5, saying it isn't only wrong to kill, it's wrong to feel like killing. And Augustine and Aquinas say that it is possible that a given military undertaking might be justified objectively in the regard to all the things we've been talking about. But if you have hate in your heart, it's still a sin. Because you must fight without hating the enemy. The intention must not be bitterness, vindictiveness, vengefulness, hatred. It must be regretfully and mournfully that you go into the battle, only for the objective intention of restoring peace, and not out of any desire to destroy the people you're going to have to destroy, unfortunately.
Does the unjust objectives of the attacking army justify defense? So your participation in defense against an unjust...
Well, the way the criteria are set up, they don't go around from the other side and measure whether it's unjust, except indirectly saying, if we have a just cause, then of course somebody must have done us wrong.
Or
be threatening to do us wrong.
The enemy's objectives in going to
war
against...
So it does have to mean that the enemy's objectives are unjust, otherwise we wouldn't have a just cause in defending ourselves against that enemy. But the fact that the enemy has unjust objectives does not yet suffice. If he is so overwhelmingly strong that we can't win against him, then that we don't have a just war anyway, because it's not winnable. So the fact that the other guy is bad doesn't prove we're good. But it's a prerequisite. It's one of the things that it'll take. There has to have been a wrong cause on the other side, obviously. There has to have been an offense. Now, the total impact of this doctrine, with its four or five major criteria and their sub-criteria, the intent of the theologians is clear. Their purpose is restraint. They don't want the crusade, the other type I spoke of at the beginning. They don't want the blank check, in which government can do whatever it wants. They believe in morality. They believe in limits. And they want to state restraints. In fact, the correct term would not be just war, but justifiable war. That is, it has the burden of the proof. A case has to be made for it. And to make that case, you have to check off these questions that always have to be asked. The five criteria and their sub-criteria. Now, we can ask, in the Middle Ages, how this was applied. Did the prince sit down and have this checklist and make his own decision, or did he call in a theological advisory commission and they had this in their files? Or might it have been only that he first fought and then he came to the confessional and the priest told him whether it was a sin or not, depending on whether he met the requirements? It isn't clear how this doctrine operated in actual decision-making process in the Middle Ages. But at least one way it might operate was that a citizen might himself, if he had information, decide that the war that his lord was telling him to fight, a soldier, might decide that the war he was being told to fight in was not justified, and then he might decide that although he's not a pacifist, he still shouldn't fight in this war. That's a possibility which, as far as I know, is first stated by Martin Luther, whose writing on the question of whether soldiers can be in a state of grace is generally quite affirmative about the possibility of Christian war, but on the edge he recognizes logically this possibility that if you really know that your Lord is telling you to go off and fight a wrong war, you shouldn't go. In fact, you should even be willing to suffer for not going. You should be willing to bear the cross of being persecuted for your refusal, for being a selective conscientious objector, if you really know. Now, Luther is very modest about how much a soldier can know. He doubts that many soldiers will really know enough about the facts of the case to be able to second-guess their princes. And in case of doubt, you should give your prince the burden, the benefit of the doubt, because he knows so much more than you do. That's the Nixon secret theory. If you really know that what you're being asked to do is unjust, you must not do it as a Christian. War has the burden of proof. A war, a declaration of war, has the burden of proof at the point of just cause and just authority. Every weapon, every strategy, every campaign has the burden of proof at the point of the criteria of means, proportionality and all that. Well, this is simply describing a doctrine. It's not what I hold to myself as the Christian gospel. It is something that I'm concerned to take seriously because it is part of the conviction of those people who think seriously in the majority Christian groups. And it can be appealed to, as it was in the case of Vietnam, not very often before that, to bring to bear serious restraint or at least serious critique on how long a war is going to last or how it's going to be fought. I'll ask more of my own questions Monday about the limits and the usability of this doctrine, but for the next few minutes that we still have, I'd suggest that we just limit ourselves to trying to clarify it. How does it work, or how would it work? What do these phrases mean? We've already identified in the earlier pair of questions the difficulty of applying it once we think of the right to work or the right to food as things that are taken away from poor people by a structure, things they never had. And that's one of the difficulties in application. But remembering, this comes from the Middle Ages. It started to be thought about in the 4th and 5th centuries when Christians found themselves in charge of the Roman Empire instead of being its victims and needed to have guidelines for what it means to be a Christian Caesar. It was developed as Christian thought developed through the Middle Ages and most systematically in the 16th and 17th centuries. That is the majority Christian view on the question of war, according to the texts. Crusade is not justified because war can't, in the minds of most Christians anymore, most Christian theologians, be an instrument of the cause of the church and her mission of redemption. The rejection of the blank check, in which there's no restraint at all, therefore there must be restraint, and the restraint will be organized according to this structure of a set of questions to ask. What does it take to understand the system?
The choice of the word just seems almost... the problems are almost insurmountable because it suggests that we're involved with our own justification. That is, you're dealing with it politically, you're trying to make it credible, but maybe it's not possible to even use that word.
Well, the word itself is, in recent usage, already a slight... cheapening or a drift in the direction of what you're criticizing. The classical doctrine didn't say just war. It said just cause. The word just was used in an adjective only for the cause. For the government, you said legitimate, and for the means, you said necessary and proportionate. So it was more sober language. It's only kind of the lay usage of it that uses just war for the whole thing. And I prefer, I mean, I think it would be more faithful to the tradition to say justifiable war. That is, it's something you make a case for. And you only have the right to fight those wars for which you can make a credible case.
And that's a political case.
Yeah. Well, it's this kind of an argument. It doesn't mean righteous before God.
Yes.
It means something you can explain you have to do.
I think this will raise something you probably want to get into on Monday, but the one criterion that is most confusing to me is the one that the means must be proportionate to the offense, because it assumes that going to war is a punishment and not a desire to win.
Well, you could say it's a prevention.
But how can you determine what the proportion of the damage will be until you know how much resistance is going to be put up? It's assumed that you're already winning the war, and then you will mete out justice somehow by punishing the enemy. But if the enemy resists, certainly the punishment, no, the evil will be...
No, punishment is another category. It might be that you should punish people like at Nuremberg because there is an international law system that they need to be punished under, but that's separate. The proportionality is the damage you're preventing,
right,
over against the damage that you're causing.
I'm just suggesting...
And your generals are supposed to know how to calculate that.
Yeah, it seems to be very difficult to control the damage you're causing.
Yeah, that it's difficult to control is a problem about the whole business, because anything where you use violence and break down normal restraints is likely to go too far. But that was not assumed. Remember that when this started, we were in the good old days in which one soldier could only kill one soldier at a time because he had to get close to him with a sword, or at least within throwing distance with a lance. So the scale of the military operation was, in a sense, manageable. It was war was fought by professionals or by mercenaries. And the scale was of such an order that you could only fight one battle at a time, and then you'd have to go back and lick your wounds and get new supplies, and you could only fight again in a couple of weeks. So the applicability of these criteria of size and proportion and defined finite goals and measurable damage is kind of all made sense in the Middle Ages. Now, one of our questions is whether you can update any of this. But it's credible where it started.
Maybe I can put it in other terms. If the offense is merely that the enemy has taken a small amount of land, it would seem that you should only send 100 soldiers. But if the enemy has 1,000 soldiers, you must send
1,100
soldiers. And that's where it doesn't make any sense to me. You're going to do more damage if the enemy has a large force to fight. Then it's always going to be completely out of proportion.
The moral restriction of it as well.
I was just going to ask, we're talking about the Middle Ages and how this applied to war then, and we're a supposedly Christian country now. Is any of this applied in the military academies or the training of our military personnel today? Is it impossible going into?
I should have updated in order to answer that question. This is all talking about what Christian theologians say. This then has to be translated into the language of political science and military science. And this is done. Whether it's done well is another question. But it is translated into, for instance, international law. Hugo Grotius was the great Christian theologian who was also a politician. And he took this whole body of moral thought and turned it around and made of it international law so the courts could apply it. And our whole concept of international law goes back to this man Grotius. So that there are secular legal statements of some of these criteria. What is the meaning of sovereignty? What is what is the meaning of a declaration of war? How does a cooling off period work? What do arbitrators use when they want to make peace? A lot of this has its legal equivalents in the terms of international courts. And secondly, it is transposed into military rules. How decent a country is will determine how careful they are about it. Our own military academies don't teach it a lot, but it is there in the books. Students in ROTC programs or in their military and Air Force academies have access to this information as somewhere along their education. Not very thoroughly as far as I've been able to find out, but I haven't studied deeply. But in principle, they would say yes, that a soldier learns that he's not supposed to kill civilians. After the My Lai exposures, there was an extra effort on the part of the Pentagon to make sure that all soldiers knew what the rules were. And in fact, they had very readable pamphlets, kind of in your field of adult basic education. It is simple, and yet for soldiers, for grown-up people with guns in their hands, about what you shouldn't do with a gun. So in principle, yes. Effectively, I'm not sure. But, yeah.
In your next talk, will you be examining the justness or unjustness of the American War of Independence and the war between the states or the Civil War, depending on where you come
from? We can work at that if we want to.
John.
How many people here from the South?
I'm not sure how often you've been with Lutheran groups on this. I'll speak for us so that you don't have to. For 2 years, I had a national ministry on peace and nonviolence, and found that except in a congregation where there had been a conscientious objector to the war in Vietnam, so that a young person had brought to that parish the use of the justifiable war criteria. If that had not happened, I had not found a Lutheran who knew anything about the justifiable war criteria, or much about it, could not give you any of those if you ask him, so that we do not know our tradition very well. I'll start with that point. Secondly, in the Second World War, I think there were 68 Lutheran conscientious objectors. They all knew one another. I think they were all in prison. One pastor in New York City that I talked to said, yes, we knew one another. We were a very small minority. Perhaps the place where some of these things, in our minds, we still saw how they were used would be a Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who considered himself a pacifist, who felt that the kind of criteria were applicable, that it was beyond comprehension to negotiate with an Adolf Hitler. That if you want to see the Lutheran approach, it would have been to be in on an assassination plot, to say violence is necessary. He even has the image of, if the coach driver is out of his mind, you have to stop the coach. Most Lutherans could calculate that what Hitler was doing to Jewish people, that Hitler had to be stopped.
Or to Germany.
That Hitler had to be stopped, and we, in our justifiable war criteria mentality, or that mindset, said even if it means stopping with military force or stopping that person. So those are it is not inconceivable that in recent history we've used some of these criteria. That's why most Lutherans were conscientious participants in World War II. Many were selected conscientious objectors in Vietnam. But it's not a history that we're very conversant in.
And I should have started at the beginning, asked how many of you know what's in Augsburg 16.
Glad you did.
No, the place we are taught the just war theory in our culture is not in church, but in the Western.
In the what?
In the Western. The good guy never shoots first.
That's right.
That's the criterion of cause and legitimate authority. But he always shoots straighter, and he always wins in the end. Well, you sometimes send a posse against one bandit in a Western, though. But he's got to prove that he's a bad guy first.
Yeah, he's got to be a good guy.